Morning. Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that time is currently 8:35 a.m. on Monday, February 19th, 2024. Present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Cronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. This morning we have three bills. We do have a hard stop at 9:40 in the morning. First, we'll be hearing House Bill 50. And maybe just to take a quick step back also, just kind of the plan for taking up bills is we want to, we're just trying to fit in bills wherever we can. The first and primary deal for finances is to get the budget through, and so we want to spend as much time as we can on that, and then where time permits, we've been trying to find holes in the schedule where subcommittees are not meeting, so that's why it may seem a little bit erratic, but once we push the budget out at some point in late March, early April, then we can switch over to full-time bills. So just to give folks a sense of what we're doing on bills. So the first bill we've got this morning is House Bill 50, Carbon Storage. We'll take the final round of questions for the department. They are available here today. We'll refresh the committee on the fiscal notes, set an amendment deadline, and then put the bill aside. Second bill will be House Bill 126, which is licensing of associate and professional counselors. And on that bill, we'll take public testimony. Since there were no amendments, we'll review the fiscal notes, and if it is the will of the committee, we'll move that bill out of House Finance. And after that, we do have House Bill 115, which is licensing and practices for naturopaths. And this is the first hearing for that bill here in this committee. So we'll introduce the bill, hear it, hear from the sponsor, and then set that aside. So with that, first up, we've got House Bill 50, which is the carbon storage bill. The intent today is to, again, take final rounds of questions that we may have for the departments, review the fiscal notes for a final time, and then set the amendment deadline. I'd like to call the Department of Natural Resources Deputy Commissioner John Crowther up to the table, and if you can put yourself on the record. Also, I'd like to note that we've got online and available for questions Brett Huber, Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee, Commission, Haley Payne, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas, Ryan Fitzpatrick with the Division of Oil and Gas, Marwin Wartz with the Division of Geologic and Geophysical Surveys. So with that, Deputy Commissioner Crowther, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good morning, Co-Chair Foster and members of the committee. Great to be here this morning. With respect to the busy agenda you all have, I think I can move quite quickly through the memorandum response we provided to the committee. It's dated February 14th. There were two questions that we answered there. The first was a question from Representative Josephson around enhanced oil recovery and taxes as addressed in the bill. The summary that we provided there, just to very quickly speak to it, talked about how in the House Resources Committee there was an amendment to remove our state corporate income tax incorporates by reference the federal income tax code, and so we removed the ability for the state or the obligation under current law for the state to provide 45Q tax credits because it's in the federal code. So that amendment was made, and then we also addressed briefly the fact that under the bill's language, as currently before the committee, the lease expenditures associated with oil and gas activity have to be upstream of that oil and gas activity, upstream of the point of production necessary for its production. And so while operators may pay a variety of taxes, both under the production tax and the state corporate income tax, there's not expected to be a significant impact there from the bill as drafted. And then we also have a question about seismicity and the impacts that could have on Cook Inlet. You'll see in our response, we have a detailed discussion of both historically the seismic activity we've seen in the inlet, the nature of that seismic activity, and how we understand the impact with the potential sequestration of carbon dioxide. But I think if the committee has additional questions, we have our Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey staff online who can speak directly to that. But we also talk in that response, of course, about how the Class 6 regulations require a variety of assessments of the and real-time monitoring of the sequestered carbon so that seismic activity doesn't result in a release.
And maybe before we go to questions, if we could just get the refresher on the fiscal notes, and then we'll open it up to questions on the bill or the fiscal notes.
Happy to, Chair. So there's four fiscal notes, I believe, in the packet. The first one from the Department of Natural Resources. We anticipate that existing capacity can cover the program as proposed in the legislation, and so there's no additional operating costs for our department. The revenues are indicated as indeterminate. Similarly, for the Department of Revenue fiscal note, there's not an additional operating cost expected, but the revenues are indicated as indeterminate there. And then the Division of Environmental Conservation similarly has a fiscal note that in prior fiscal notes from the department, there were some costs, but that has been adjusted to reflect the reality that there's not an expected expenditure for DEC to regulate this program. And I believe Commissioner Brett Huber from the AOGCC is online. I'd let him speak to his fiscal note if he's available.
Commissioner Huber, if you could put yourself on the record and address the fiscal note for the commission.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Brett Huber. I'm the chairman and commissioner for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Our fiscal note shows our appropriation request for 2025, included in the governor's budget. That's personal services of 388. That's two individuals on staff, a senior carbon engineer and an assistant for that senior engineer in-house. It also shows $350,000 for services, as we will have likely use some external contractors to help us through the primacy process. The fiscal note then transitioned into the out-year estimates, 26, 27, 28. Those are our best estimates of what we believe the program may cost to operate. It's difficult to put a more specific number on that, as we do not know how many applicants we may have or how many folks it will be interested in utilizing our services to determine whether they want to be in the carbon sequestration business. It is the intent of the legislation that the industry itself will fund the regulatory process, the cost through AOGCC. There are provisions in the bill to allow that, similar to what we do with our regulatory cost charge for oil and gas currently. I believe that covers it briefly, Mr. Chairman. Happy to address questions if you have any.
Great, thank you. And Deputy or Mr. Crowther, was there anybody else that you wanted to make maybe some opening statements before we move to questions?
Co-Chair Foster, I don't think that's necessary at this time.
Great. Okay, thank you. So I think I saw Representative Josephson first, I believe, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Josephson.
Through the Chair, Deputy Commissioner, this issue that has arisen about EPA's requirement that the purveyor, the owner, the contributor, whatever adjective or we want to use, or noun, I guess, of the carbon carbon dioxide must remain entitled for 50 years. My first question is, and this isn't intended to, I'm sort of indifferent about how this got missed, but how did it get missed? How, in other words, when I say I'm indifferent, I'm not upset at anyone. I'm just curious, how is it that something so critical could get lost?
Yeah, Representative Josephson, through the chair, I wouldn't deign to be an expert on, you know, the primacy interrelationship, the federalism relationship between state and federal governments in regulatory programs where states assume primacy. But from my general knowledge, the program for Class 6 for carbon sequestration regulation is very similar to others in that states have to develop programs, have them reviewed and approved by a federal partner, and there's generally a requirement that they be as stringent or similarly regulatorily stringent as the federal program. there's often a great deal of discretion and variation in how a federal agency implements that mandate. And so I think our thinking and many other states' thinking a year or two ago was that the EPA has promulgated a class six rule with that 50-year period in it. But if we can design a program that includes liability and title ownership, different kinds of cost and structure charges to protect the interest and requirements for monitoring, that functionally achieves the same ends and is thus the federal agency can interpret to be as restrictive or as stringent as. So we expected that there'd be, that perhaps you could say the federal government would exercise discretion to view that as a equally extensive regulatory program by the state. Now that we've seen specifically in the Louisiana context how the EPA has interpreted and applied that, you know, they've interpreted their requirement to be stringently. So it's now looking like flexible or adaptive approaches are significantly disfavored. And so I don't think it's as much of a miss in how the program was crafted as just an increasing understanding about how the federal regulator is performing its discretionary role, my characterization.
Why is it that the state would ever, and maybe this is just sort of the culture behind it, but why would the state ever want to have title to the carbon? And what does that mean about the stream of payments we receive and liability?
Mr. Crowther?
Sort of a compound question.
Mr. Crowther?
Yeah, Representative Josephson through the chair. So I think the original structure of the legislation as it's before the committee today, of course, we anticipate some amendments in response to those EPA inputs, anticipated that the state assuming the title and having a transfer of facilities after a period of review, after a period of closure with monitoring and trust funds in place, the intent there was for the state, the kind of perpetual sovereign with a perpetual interest in the proper regulation and operation of the facility, is able to, perhaps you could say, backstop a project and allow projects to be developed, be pursued and undertaken by developers without a, you know, perpetual obligation, a 50-year obligation. Now that we still believe that, you know, the EPA's regulatory program being applicable across the board, that's the environment that operators and developers have to live with. But we were hoping that there could be a collaborative effort between the state with a significant interest in the projects going forward, but also in the projects being managed and monitored carefully, and operators and developers wanting to do projects. We thought that handoff of the facilities would kind of induce development of projects. But with the regulatory environment from the EPA, that's not a inducement or a structure that we're able to provide so directly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Crowther, this may be a question for revenue. The response question about that Representative Josephson had asked and that was answered about 45Q credits reminded me that that's sort of only half the potential question. Because under the current bill, eligible lease expenditures for enhanced oil recovery using carbon injection can still be deducted against oil production taxes. So I want to know, what are the potential impacts as that ramps up for the expenses being applied against a company's oil and gas production tax, and what's our potential lost revenue from that?
Yeah, Representative Hannon through the chair. Chair Foster, I don't recall if anyone from the Department of Revenue is on the line this morning.
I don't see anybody from Department of Revenue. If there is, feel free to speak up.
Well,
I don't hear anyone. So with that, Mr. Crowther.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak briefly to that. I think, Representative Hannon, the environment we find ourselves in right now is that enhanced oil recovery is a part of developing oil and gas fields, and so the costs associated with it are a lease expenditure under current provisions. Again, I'm speaking at the Department of Natural Resources, where we don't directly administer these programs, but and I think that environment that we see today is, you know, in our view, a very good thing. There is the increased activity, the increased recovery, you know, that we have a statutory and constitutional obligation to maximize that recovery and development. Obviously, the provisions of the revenue code are set up to manage the inflows from the production tax and the corporate income tax as the maximum development and royalty recovery proceeds. But I think that where we are today, we view as a good outcome. Now, in the event that there's increased enhanced oil recovery associated with these programs, there might be increased lease expenditures. In a very hypothetical sense, we may be able to do some hypothetical modeling of that, but I think we view that, like this status quo that we have today, as a good thing in terms of ultimate recovery, both from a royalty perspective, but also from an economic perspective. And I think that's confined just to the question of development and recovery from a tax sense. You know, I think there's also a state interest and a public policy interest in these kinds of programs, you know, these kind of programs being carbon capture and sequestration going forward, in the sense that our commodity may become more competitive and our environmental footprint may be lessened. So I think we can work with the Department of Revenue maybe to share some hypotheticals, but I think that kind of framework is how the administration and the department view the issue.
Follow up? Yeah, and I guess, you know, when we started talking about this bill a year ago, it was presented as a revenue producer with some substantial opportunities. But I kind of, as we dig into it, see that there's as much risk for us losing revenue. Production increasing, yes, but loss of revenue over the near term, and then, yeah. So I'd like to see a little bit more from revenue in the modeling of, we've lost the fiscal notes that produced it as a revenue, predicted as to be a revenue producer. And I'm wondering if that's why, when we look at that capital investment over the 10-year span, not reducing our revenue by allowing this.
And maybe if my staff and Mr. Crother can maybe reach out to Department of Revenue and maybe see if we can get a little more something in writing, I guess, from Department of Revenue or the division. I think we've got Representative, was that wrap up? Thank you, Representative Galvin and Representative Staff.
Thank you so much, Co-Chair Foster. And I just want to reflect a tiny bit, if I may. I remember when we were first introduced to sequestration above ground and below ground, we were all so excited, because we thought this would be the big time for revenue. And right now I'm looking at the only fiscal note I see is a decrement of $738,000. So I have a few questions related to that. I understand and very much am empathetic to the need for us to be environmentally responsible, particularly allowing avenues for corporations to have development that will attract investors. And at the same time, I want to make sure that we're being careful around what we're spending and losing and gaining in the process. And so my question, I have a couple of questions. One is, I think I heard the previous speaker mention the business of carbon sequestration from the one who was speaking to Andy, Representative Josephson's question. And with that in mind, my question is there a space for Alaska to gain revenue specifically from the carbon sequestration? That's the first question.
Mr. Crother?
Yeah, Representative Galvin, through the chair, I think there's four kind of revenues, you know, central revenue scenarios as we see them that could have a positive revenue impact to the state. The first, and I'll kind of go from order of magnitude to smallest to largest, and, you know, three and four are a question, I think, of the potential magnitude. The first is the use of carbon capture sequestration on state lands that involves, you know, state injection fees or other commercial receipts that for in-state uses. So something like an in-state power plant, potentially even activity on the North Slope with existing generation and emissions. So that could generate fees for the state, is an area direct revenue. And I think that, you know, that's kind of one and two, one being in-state power generation or other in-state industrial activities, two being adoption on the North Slope by existing operations. I think number three, which is a potentially much more significant revenue generation, but does have needs market development, needs international development, is the importation of carbon dioxide into the state of Alaska. And I think that is potentially quite a significant revenue generator, depending on the volumes, the terms, et cetera. But we have to have this framework in place to start investigating those opportunities. And ultimately, how those opportunities develop may require, you know, additional framework regulation by the department. Maybe the legislature may want to further review and approve that kind of facility and operation on that scale. And I think the fourth kind of direct, perhaps more indirect revenue stream to the state, but a very important one from our perspective, is that as there's an increasing pressure for carbon capture, carbon management to be part of any energetic or development activity, we want to be having that opportunity and preserving the value of our other commodity resources. So mines that proceed with highly advantaged environmental footprints because there's low carbon power available, that increases the value of our minerals wealth in and of itself. Continued development on the North Slope, some operators have talked about requirements to transition to carbon neutrality or maintain different carbon footprints. And if we're attracting more investors to develop billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of hydrocarbon resources because we have a framework of CCUS available, that's a huge value preservation and generation for us. So I think we do see direct revenue generation as a discrete possibility on from in-state activities being relatively small, from import being relatively large, but also that value preservation being a key state interest. So.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I appreciate what you were saying, that we have the carbon capture on state lands and perhaps power plants, perhaps importation, perhaps just the multiplier effect that we are becoming a state that welcomes oil and gas companies to be able to do this. What I'm, I guess, and this may be along the lines of the questioning we heard before, but I think it's slightly different. We know that some oil companies are reinjecting already and have been for quite some time to help them continue their production of oil and gas, or I think you're calling it enhancement, yes? The question is, once it gets beyond enhancement or something other than that, is there a way for the state to capture if they are injecting for other reasons? Have we talked about a price structure or revenue structure if it's beyond what they need for enhancement?
Yeah, Representative Galvin, through the chair, I think if I understand the question, the bill does contemplate the commissioner setting commercial terms for access to state subsurface resources. So the use of state land has we would generate a value through a process of setting that commercial access rate. There's things like injection fees, things like acreage lease rental fees. And so that's a value stream that would come directly to the state, you know, a cash value stream associated with the activity. And I think that, in our mind, that's the best way for the state to participate in that value stream and value chain when there's pure sequestration activities. Now, there's certainly also the ability under the flexibility in the bill as drafted for things like if there's an increase in the 45Q tax credit, the state could negotiate an increase, you know, a subsequent increase in its fees down the line in a project. And so that kind of flexibility we think is there today to get the value from the pure sequestration in the event that kind of activity proceeds.
Okay, thank you. I do have another question, if I may.
Representative Galvin.
I appreciate all of your thorough answers regarding the seismicity and other things. What I on page two, I'm reading reasonable confidence in the long-term integrity of the potential sequestration sites. Reasonable confidence is what I'm trying to comprehend what that means. Does that mean if we have a 100-year seismic activity that then that confidence goes down? November 30, we had a pretty big earthquake, and I'm just trying to be very responsible here. And if reasonable confidence stays, if there's a 100-year earthquake near that site, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Representative Galvin. I have our energy program manager from the Division of Geological Geophysical Surveys online that I think might be best posed to speak to the exact language used. You know, I'd note here in the third paragraph in our response to question two, we talk about, the 1964 quake, which is one of the largest earthquakes ever recorded on the planet. Obviously, in our geologic history, I'm sure there's been earthquakes of similar similar size, but in recorded human history, that one is near the top. And we have not seen evidence of migration or impacts to the different reservoirs holding hydrocarbons from the context of that earthquake. And so I think when we talk about reasonable confidence, that may be a highly scientific kind of, you can never guarantee that there won't be a magnitude 15 earthquake and the planet won't shake apart. My words, I'm sure scientists would disagree with that characterization, but that we have reasonable confidence that the spectrum of activity we've seen to date will continue and that there won't be issues associated there. But Marwan Wortes may have some additional supplementation there.
Mr. Marwan Wortes, if you're online, can you state your put yourself on the record?
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Marwan Wortes. I'm Energy Resources Section Chief at DNR's Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Yeah, through the chair, regarding that question, I think Deputy Commissioner Crowther accurately summed that up in particularly pointing out that reasonable confidence is sort of intended to capture the statistical uncertainty. Because we cannot accurately, precisely predict a given earthquake, all the characterizations of a seismic hazard end up being probabilistic. And yes, Cook Inlet does have a long history of earthquakes, but the infrastructure and planning and regulatory structure are also built around that known risk. And so the evaluation that has to go on for approving any development, whether it's a pipeline or a platform or anything, all is keeping in consideration the known seismic risk and sort of ground accelerations and these sort of details. So.
Thank you. May I ask one follow-up of the gentleman?
Follow-up, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Is this also flow that's the same information that you've given fit for the North Slope in that region? I know that other companies up there are hoping to use the same process, and I just want to make sure that there's been sort of the same type of study and thinking about seismic activity up there as well, and whether it gets into water, et cetera.
Yes, through the chair, thank you. Good question. The North Slope is widely recognized as a lot lower seismic risk. It's quite stable. There is some seismicity to the east and towards Anwar. But overall, I think the folks at AOGCC would still provide the same level of requirements and oversight. But I think the expectations for seismic risk are just much, much lower to the north.
Great. Thank you. I have one last question.
Sure. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I believe that this is more than CO2, but I could be wrong, and I wondered if you would expand upon that.
Mr. Crowther.
Yeah, Representative Galvin, through the chair, the intent of the legislation in these operations is to inject essentially pure, highly compressed CO2 underground. Now, obviously, a given waste stream may have other constituent parts, and so they would have to be managed potentially through injection, disposal through other wells. or other appropriate management and treatment. But the, you know, that's an area of significant experience. You know, produced fluids, produced gases are actively managed today as in all sorts of permutations as part of oil and gas operations. So the focus of the program would be pure CO2, but of course, other associated things would have to be managed as well.
May I ask one?
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I appreciate your description of essentially CO2. Would you be so kind as to offer what other things, other elements we might expect? And I think it is the normal behavior of or necessity of oil and gas. I appreciate that, but I just want to make sure that we have an understanding of what that is.
Yeah, I think my chemical science limit, Representative Galvin, through the chair, my chemical science limitations may prevent me from really confidently, definitively answering that question. But, you know, things like hydrocarbons in the stream are flammable, have different behavior when compressed. They need to be removed, normal part of gas handling and treatment. Things like water create corrosion when in the presence of carbon dioxide because of the creation of carbonic acid. So they need to be moved. Gas needs to be dehydrated. There may be other things, other gases, largely inert, that may persist because they're not able to be filtered totally out of the stream. But the intent, things like nitrogen present in the air all around us, smaller weight gases that may naturally occur in a produced stream or as a flue gas output. So I think those, the intent is to get 99 or higher percent CO2 concentrated and remove anything that has an interaction with the system or the processing equipment out of the stream entirely. So that's my understanding. We can follow up in writing if we need. Certainly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks. Mr. Dan Stickwell, the Department of Revenue, popped on, but may not be on anymore. Mr. Dan Stickwell, are you online?
I am here.
Oh, great. I wanted to maybe give Representative Hannon the opportunity to ask her question again, and if you could answer it now, that's fine, or if you wanted a little bit of time to write something up, that's fine too. So first of all, Representative Hannah, if you'd like to restate your question.
Thank you, Chair Foster, through the chair. So Mr. Stickle, my concern is about as we, in theory, carbon sequestration expands and more enhanced oil recovery using carbon injection is used and that deduction is allowable under the bill against oil production taxes, how will that impact our oil production tax revenue?
And Mr. Stickle, if you can put yourself on the record, just state your name and your position.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. And I apologize, I had not been following the beginning of this hearing. So the question really relates to what extent expenditures on carbon storage would count as lease expenditures for the oil and gas production tax. To the extent that expenditures are on lease and used for enhanced oil recovery, those potentially could be allowable lease expenditures that could reduce production tax. It really depends on who is making the expenditure and whether it is on lease for enhanced oil recovery versus another storage option. And I think we would want to look at the final version of the bill with any potential amendments and provide some commentary there.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Through the chair. So, Mr. Stickle, yes, some of my thinking, last year we saw fiscal notes on this bill with expectations of substantial income produced over a period of 10 years, and we don't have those fiscal notes anymore. And we've addressed the issue of 45Q and the federal tax code, but our own oil production tax. And so that's what I was looking to see, is that why we no longer have an expectation of large revenue production? Is it because it will affect our oil production tax?
Great. Thank you. Mr. Stickle, do you have any other comments on that?
Sure. Representative Hannon, through the chair, it's a valid concern, and you're asking the right question. I think we'd want to take a look at the final language of the bill with any potential amendments and make those before we make any final commentary.
Okay, thank you. So next up, I've got Representative Stapp and then Representative Josephson. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, maybe to Mr. Stickle as well as our wonderful carbon folks. So my question is actually, I'm going to kind of maybe elaborate a little bit about what my colleague Representative Hannon just kind of talked about. So I know there's the distinction between the Class 2 wells, which is the enhanced oil recovery wells, and the Class 6 wells, which is carbon sequestration. I don't have the background to kind of understand all the technical details, but here's what I do know. I know that the Inflation Reduction Act increased the commodity price of CO2 artificially through the 45Q credits, right? I know that depending on what companies do up on the North Slope, if they sequester carbon from Class 2 through the purpose of industrial power generation or through direct air capture, they can get as much money as $60 a ton to $130 a ton, right? So I don't know if they do this stuff already and qualify for the 45Q. I know that they do enhanced oil recovery, but I don't know if they can qualify for the Fed money, right? What I would not like to see happen is them look at a federal revenue stream that's been enhanced through 45Q and say, I'm going to build a new generation facility or direct air capture facility for the purpose of getting that money and then taking it out on the money that they would otherwise have to pay the state through the production tax. So that's kind of what I would not like to see happen. And I'm not sure if this bill allows that or doesn't allow that, because I don't have the technical expertise. But from my perspective, I don't think we want to incentivize people to get a federal resource that they may or may not get right now on the dime of our state production tax. So, but otherwise, I think this bill is really awesome, and it works out great for North Dakota, and that's really my own concern. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Crowther. Staff, through the chair, I guess would a way to paraphrase your question be, does a project that receives a 45Q and to some degree has a reduction in an otherwise state obligation, do the sum of those two things exceed the cost and thus make people do things that otherwise they wouldn't do at all?
Yeah, I can simplify too for follow-up, Co-Chair Foster.
Representative Stapp.
So basically, they're already doing this stuff. Now there's Fed money to do this stuff. Maybe they make some tweaks and they make us pay for that stuff. All right? That's as simple, I think, I could make that. I don't want to see that happen.
Mr. Crowther?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Stapp. I think, why don't the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue kind of respond in writing on that one? Because okay. I think it's a complex answer, but I think there's also some clarity we can provide there.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner, I attended in October and spoke at a forum on water quality in the Cook Inlet. That was a two-day forum attended by, tribes, the Coast Guard, the federal government, nonprofits. There are grave concerns about water quality in Cook Inlet. My question, and so I'm more concerned with Cook Inlet, where there are a lot of people, than the North Slope, where there are people, for example, in New Ixit that might have real concerns. But can you remind me about exemptions that the industry enjoys in Cook Inlet relative to the production of something either called slurry or some sort of sludge that gets that is allowed to be deposited into the inlet? Am I right that such a thing exists and is uncommon in the industry worldwide?
Mr. Crowther?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I believe you may be referring to different DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation discharge authorities, which I just don't want to speak to and misstate, so we can work with our sister agency to follow up there as to the kind of current authorizations in Cook Inlet.
Follow up?
Would you, I don't mean to burden with you with that, would you want to do that, or should I contact DEC directly?
I think we'd be happy to speak to that in the context of the legislation, which but I, of course, if you'd like to talk to DC about it, Representative Justin through the chair, we would welcome you to do so as well.
Representative Josephson.
One, if I could propose we both make the effort and let's see if we get the same answer twice.
Representative Josephson through the chair, that sounds good.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any further questions? Okay, seeing none, it's a little bit of a mixed bag in terms of wanting to set an amendment deadline. At the same time, I think we're going to have some questions that are kind of hanging out there. And but I think I'm going to go ahead and set the amendment deadline. We'll wait to hear back in terms of what some of the answers are and then we can gauge whether or not folks, how far we want to move forward at the next meeting. My intent from the prior meeting was to have two final meetings, one to kind of just wrap up loose ends and ask questions and set amendment deadline, and then the final meeting to take up those amendments and pass out the bill if that was the will of the committee. But everything is subject to the will of the committee, so we'll just take it one step at a time and see how things look at the next meeting. So, with that, if there are no further questions on HB 50, we'll set an amendment deadline for next Tuesday, February 27th at 5 p.m. Folks could please email or deliver your amendments to my staff, Brody Anderson, or to our finance clerk, Helen Phillips, by next Tuesday, February 27th at 5 p.m. And so with that, thank you very much, Mr. Crowther. And everyone who was online. So next we'll move to House Bill 126. Just a reminder again, we've got about 23 minutes before hard stop. Another meeting has popped up, and so we've got about just over 20 minutes. House Bill 126, which is licensing of associate and professional counselors. We had no amendments on this bill. And so first we are going to take public testimony, we'll review the fiscal notes, and if it is the will of the committee, we'll move the bill out of House Finance. So with that, I will open up public testimony on House Bill 126, which is licensing of associate professional counselors. Just a reminder that written testimony can be submitted by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. Again, house.finance@akleg.gov. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none. Oh, we do have one person. Okay. And then also, looks like we've got some people on the phone. Looks like we've actually got quite a few. Oh, gosh, we might have 10 or more here. I'm going to go ahead and set a 2 minute, 2 minutes for public testimony. So with that, if the first person in the room could come up and put yourself on the record, and if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your 2 minute testimony. Thanks for being here today.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kayla Harmon. Thank you, members, for being here this morning. I'm Kayla Harmon. I'm a lifelong Junoite, and I have my master's in clinical mental health counseling from UAF. And I am a pre-licensed counselor working in private practice here in Juneau. While I complete my hours and I take the necessary 100 hours of supervision, that's where I'm working right now. I am here to share really strong support for House Bill 126 and the companion Senate Bill 116, and that will strengthen my new career. My first career was a teacher. I was a teacher here in Juneau for 15 years. When I graduated, I got my initial teaching license, and I was immediately a classroom teacher. After 2 years, I applied and received my professional teaching license, which I still actively hold here in the state of Alaska. In my new profession, there's no such license between the time I graduate to the time that I have completed my 3,000 hours, my supervision, and I become a professional licensed counselor, LPC, here in the state. It really creates an ethical gray area for me, and I feel that supervisors as well, I'm speaking from a pre-licensed position, but I feel that supervisors also really want some clarity in this two-year gray period. I'm doing really important work with clients, and I don't have any specific code of conduct from the state. Counseling really needs to catch up with other professions, such as teaching, and really catch up with national standards. Throughout the country, there's an LPCC, an associate counselor position. Alaska really needs to kind of catch up to what's going on nationwide. And additionally, passing this legislation would increase access to affordable mental health care here in Alaska, like bar none. Several large insurers allow associate counselors to bill insurance directly, and other states have this in place. Alaskans deserve more access, and passing this legislation is really straightforward. I believe it's revenue generating because I will be paying for these licenses, and I really think it's a bipartisan effort. I look forward to its swift passage, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
Great, thank you. Do we have any questions? Okay, seeing no questions, thank you so very much for coming in today. I'm going to do something slightly unorthodox here, which is maybe if we could have the bill sponsor come up as well as his staff and put yourself on the record. Can you just give the committee, I jumped right into public testimony, and maybe just want to get, we're switching track from carbon storage to your bill, and I wanted to just maybe if you could give the quick one-minute reminder as to what exactly the bill does.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the chair. Thank you to the members of the committee for hearing this legislation. HB 126, it basically creates an associate professional license, an associate license designation. I do have my staff here, Ms. Rachel Gunn, who will go through a very brief, I promise.
Great. Thank you. Representative Stanley Wright. So your staffer, Ms. Rachel Gunn, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, through the chair. For the record, I am Rachel Gunn. I believe I can speak pretty quickly for anyone who's had to be around me for any period of time. HB 26 introduces an associate counselor tier within the counseling profession for behavioral health postgraduates along their pathway to full licensure. By streamlining the route for graduates, we can facilitate professional growth and the ability to serve Alaska's mental health needs more effectively. We are aligning Alaska with the high training standards already required on a national level and enhancing the method of reporting during the mandatory supervisory phase, directly improving the quality of care for Alaskans accessing the services. This bill is actually aligning Alaska with the majority of states by adopting this tiered licensure system.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Representative Wright. Did you have any other comments? Okay, thank you. Okay, is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go on to the phone lines. Looks like we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So first up, we've got Rachel Budin-Young. If you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your two-minute testimony. Ms. Budin-Young, are you online? We will.
Yes.
Oh, okay. If you can state your name, sorry, and your affiliation.
Rachel Budin-Young. I'm a licensed professional counselor. I also serve on the board for LPCs for the state of Alaska. I'm really here to answer any questions that come up, as I've been the one who's kind of been helping forge this forward so that we can get Alaska in line with national standards and also provide better quality health care for Alaskans. And this is going to create more stability and structure for both supervisors and supervisees. So it's going to be just a win-win all the way around. And that's all I have.
Great. Thank you very much. And she is, let's see, I think you said professional counselors board. Do we have any questions? Seeing no questions. Thank you very much. Next up, we've got Doreen Hagen calling in from Homer. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Board Chair. My name is Dory Hagen, and I live in Homer, Alaska. I'm a licensed professional counselor of a private practice, and I also work for another organization as a clinical manager. And I am a board-approved supervisor. And so from the perspective of getting a master's degree and pursuing licensure, I really appreciate what was stated earlier by someone as far as ethical gray areas. You know, just not quite even sure where to step. I'm having some ideas, but not real clear structure. So I just love the structure with this. It's a streamlined process as well as the what we can put into place with regards to supervision too. So the supervision piece and the associate licensing piece, just really being able to promote as best practices we can, catching up with national standards. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? I see no questions. Looks like we lost a few people. We've got six more folks who'd like to testify. Ms. Terry Frost, calling from Juneau. Can you state your name, your affiliation?
Hi, Terry Forrest. I'm a licensed professional counselor and board-approved supervisor in private practice here in Juneau. I work specifically and exclusively with first responders, and I'm constantly seeking new counselors to train in the field of working with first responders, as there's only, you know, a dozen or so first responder specialists in Alaska and over 1,000 first responders. So the amount of trauma, cumulative stress that they experience on their job, as we all know, we need more mental health professionals that are competent and trained in working with this population due to its uniqueness. So because of there not being an associate license, it's really hard on the bottom line of private practices and supervisors to be able to train new clinicians. So I really think this path with associate level licensure can allow us to train, to bill for their services, and to have more structure to be able to train in not only just mental health care access for Alaskans, but in the specialty area. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Forrest. I believe I don't see any questions of the committee. So next we'll go over to Elaine Border, calling you from Anchorage. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hello, my name is Elaine Border. I'm the owner of Border Counseling Services. I am an LPC and an LPC supervisor. Previously, before I became a supervisor, I owned a medical billing business for 14 years. So I have experience on both sides. And I want to echo some of the things that's already been said, but I want to hone in on the fact that this bill, giving us this licensure, is going to create two very important things. One, it's going to keep people from frauding the insurance companies, which actually is happening right now because I've heard lots of horror stories because people aren't billing this correctly. And as we said, it's a revenue stream for people who are in private practice because we cannot bill Blue Cross without this licensure. And Blue Cross is one of the leading insurance companies here in our state. The other thing is that I'm going to add to the 3,000 hours. When somebody comes out of college and they are in their postgraduate hours, they don't know what they're doing. I've heard horror stories. And then they actually have to go work for one of the machines, the South Central Community Mental Health. And those 3,000 hours of time that they're trying to get their licensure, they're not specifying into the population that they want to actually practice in. So when they become licensed, they still have to kind of start all over again. And this will allow us as supervisors to create a standard and help us be able to supervise better and help those people go into the places where they need to in their specialty. I highly recommend you pass this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Border. I don't see any questions from the committee. Next, we'll go to Sammy O'Neill calling in from Eagle River. If you can state your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your two-minute testimony.
Yes, my name is Sammy O'Neill. I'm a licensed professional counselor as well as a licensed professional counselor supervisor, as well as the vice chair for the licensed professional counselor board. Just to reiterate what everybody else ahead of me has said, Only other thing I would add in there is that the support with supervisor changes kind of helps people with the military as well when they're PCSing into the state, where a lot of the state already have the associate level in place. I think with us, that will help as well with the military, so we don't have to continue to start over with someone that's PCSing under law 48. Other than that, I think it's a good thing that Rachel is doing, and we definitely need to step up to what the standard is throughout the United States and get more people that are really qualified to be professional counselors in this state. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions from the committee. Thanks for your testimony. Next, we'll go to Rebecca Sheeran, calling in from Juneau. If you can state your name, your affiliation.
Hello. Yes, this is Rebecca Sheeran. I appreciate the time to speak with you guys today. And I just kind of want to echo a lot of what's already been said. But my unique perspective is that I'm an intern. I'm still just about to be done with my master's program, and I'm in a community health center where, because they can't bill for my time because we don't have this mental counselor's title, I'm kind of sitting around going to a lot of groups and not getting the experience that I need to be able to become competent and do my job. I'm in an online school, and most of the students that are with me are from other states, and I can see that their caseloads are double and triple what I'm being able to see because I'm not a billable hour. I'm not being able to be given any clients to see except for ones that really medication is the best treatment for them. So I'm just kind of going to echo what everybody else is saying, and I think this allows us to be able to build so we have more confidence, and there's such a great need. So many people have waiting lists, so this will just kind of help serve the community and meet the mental health needs that you need to meet.
Great. Thank you very much. We do have a question, Ms. Sheeran, from Representative Stout.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Ms. Sheeran. Hey, I really appreciate your testimony, and I think you answered my question in your testimony, but I'm just going to ask you anyways. So rarely in life do I see like regulatory frameworks being added, being able to add more of a position. But it sounds like that if we create this regulatory framework, we will actually net more counselors, which I think is probably the goal of what we would like. So in your opinion, as someone who is right there at the cusp of this process, if we pass this bill, do you think we're going to get more counselors or less counselors?
Gosh, I haven't really thought about that. I definitely know that there are counselors that are coming. I don't know if this will net more, but it would actually be able to support them in their growth and their learning so that they're competent because they'd be able to bill for their time. And I would imagine that that would, in the end, net more counselors because they won't have that barrier to being able to complete their career and do it competently.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Next up, we have Piper, I believe, Thaler, calling in from Juneau. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes. Hi, my name is Piper Thaler. I'm a licensed professional counselor in the state of Alaska and have been for the last 12 years. I'm also a board-approved supervisor. I've worked for both the community mental health agencies in Juneau that serve the vast majority of folks seen there. And I also now have a private practice. So I've been a clinical director. I've been a program manager and a crisis program manager for behavioral health in Juneau and outside of Juneau as well. I'm licensed in 3 states. I've worked in 5, and I can tell you nothing has been like this. Alaska is very unique in what is not offered, and it's imperative that you do this. I appreciated what Kayla Herman said, but it's not just getting in line with teachers. It's getting parity with the LCSWs and LMFTs. The licensed clinical social workers and marriage and family therapists in our state have an associate license. We do not, and we have the same amount of education required that they do. Every other state sees it as equivalent. Every other state treats it the same. I really don't understand why we haven't. And so on the issue of parity, it's imperative that we get this handled. To give you an example, just to answer the question that was asked of Rebecca, this bill would allow therapists to stay in our state. As a supervisor, I have four interns under me. And to give you an example, last week alone, just in the last 7 days, I have had to turn away seven clients, all with Premier Blue Cross Insurance, which paid $175 per session, purely because I have interns twiddling their thumbs and I cannot give them clients who take insurance. They can only take self-pay clients. One in 20 clients is self-pay. So that at $175 per session, knowing that most clients stay with therapy for at least a minimum of a year, that's $63,700 per year that we are losing per week purely from my practice. You multiply that across the state, and this is worth millions to us. I came to Juneau and worked because it was a rural site. Juneau, the federal government, considers us an underserved area with higher needs than most places in our country, so they offer loan repayment for service. That being said, we already don't have enough people, and the federal government sees that and tries to help us out by bringing more therapists here with incentive. If we can't keep them, two of my four interns have already said, wow, I'm getting so discouraged, I'm ready to quit. And they have not even finished their internships. This is getting them work is going to help enliven everything and help them be able to stay. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay, thank you. And I don't see any questions. So next up, we'll go lastly to Mary Fitzgerald, calling in from Juneau. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, hi, I'm Mary Fitzgerald, and I am the owner of Deeper Light Psychotherapy. And I currently have two supervisees. I am a licensed professional counselor and a supervisor, and have been in the state of Alaska for the past 12 years and love working in this state. But I echo everything that Piper Toller just stated and the frustration it is in having my supervisees be able to bill and the retention factor of having this associate license is imperative. It would streamline everything and make our lives so much more efficient in delegating the workload and being able to serve the community. And I think that that's what all of us that go into professional help really want to do, is to serve the community to the best of our ability and capacity. And we need your help in order to do that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Fitzgerald. I don't see any questions from the committee. Is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify? And I'm not seeing anyone. So with that, I will close public testimony on House Bill 126. Just a reminder, if folks would like to submit written testimony, they may do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. I am going to take a very brief at ease here. Okay, House Finance back on record. We have come up upon our hard stop here. I don't want to rush through the fiscal notes on this bill, and but I am hoping that what we'll do is we'll recess, and then if there's a hold today, we can come back later. We've got four fiscal notes, and then if it is the will of the committee, we can move the bill out. And because we've already noticed the next bill, which is our naturopath bill, that can also come up under bills previously heard. Our intent would be, if we've got enough time, to hopefully take that up later as well, if we do have a hole. So we're going to go ahead and recess House Finance at 9:39 a.m., and we'll come back at the call of the chair. So with that, House Finance is at recess.